welcome to another episode of Carolyn Talks. This is the podcast slash YouTube channel where I, your host, Carolyn Hines, film critic and journalist, speak to film creators around the world about their work, the industry, and what inspires them. And today I'm joined by filmmaker Juan Pablo Reynoso to talk about his film, Mad Props, which is a documentary about prop collecting, curation, and memorabilia. And it's about the entire process of what inspires people to become prop collectors and curating. And Chris, for me, there's a difference between collecting and curating. Curating is very specific. It's about having a very particular identity of the stories and the props you want to collect. And as well as speaking to people like Alec Gillis, who has worked on films such as Alien and Prey and a whole bunch of other sci-fi films are featured in the documentary. So we'll definitely get into that. But this is a very interesting thing for me because I love talking to people about the making of film, and this documentary encapsulates a lot of what goes into making films, such as the props and costuming. So thank you so much, Juan, for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes. So the first thing first, I have to ask you, you're a filmmaker, so tell me a bit about your background and how you got involved in the film industry.
Well, you know, I've basically been in the industry in some form since I was a little kid, since I was like six. I started as an actor, actually, in the theater, and you know, did theater my growing up, and then I went to university for that, in New York at Fordham, at Lincoln Center, and then while I was there, I had started directing, and I'd been writing since I was very young as well, and then I started directing in high school. But then when I was at Fordham, I got cast in a whole bunch of, you know, student films and stuff like that for kids at NYU and SVA. And then during that process, I started falling in love with behind the scenes. And so while I was in college, I got the opportunity to be a PA on a little indie film, which never saw the light of day. But that was my first behind the scenes like experience, and the rest is history. And then I went up the ranks, like the traditional ranks of, you know, PA, and then I became a second AD. And then I became a first AD on national commercials and music videos and that kind of thing. And with my my bilingualness, technically four-lingual, whatever that is, quatrilingual.
You mean polyglot? You're a polyglot.
A polyglot, yeah. And so I've done stuff internationally. I as a director, I kind of got delayed in really focusing on my directing career because, you know, I mean, anybody in the major city knows it's once you're making a solid living on doing something, it's hard to break free into the things that you really want to do because you're just trying to stay alive, right? And so you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. So eventually my late wife, she was she said, you know, you gotta do this. This is what you really want. I wasn't unhappy, but I wasn't doing everything I really wanted to creatively. She's like, you gotta focus on what you really want. It'll be okay. You know, it might hurt for a bit, but let's do it. And so I did. And I started solely focusing on producing and directing. And I was very fortunate. It took off from there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so tell me a bit about Mad Props, because you've had the experience of working behind the scenes and working on different types of films, just like you mentioned, in theater, but also working with music videos and then working as a producer and first AD and second AD. So you have all of this knowledge coming from the different aspects of working behind the scenes. So tell me how that plays into props, because the thing with props is, like, for the first and second ADs, you have to make sure that the props are ready for when you're ready to call action. You know, you have to make, you work closely with the prop masters and with the costume designers and the lighting technicians. So tell me about how you have been in film, because the thing is a lot of people, when they say I want to be a filmmaker, they think about just directing, telling the actors where to go and that kind of stuff. But I don't think a lot of people, when they enter into making filmmaking, they don't consider everything that goes into making a film, which is making sure that you know what props you want on set, you know what the costumes are supposed to look like, and then working with all the people, all the teams that are men that are working to bring all your this vision to life. Like, for instance, the film is about props. So as a director and as a producer as well, you have to know, like, okay, this is who I'm going to reach out to for to design this particular props, and which company, which artist, and all of these people coming together to make this particular aspect of making films. So talk to me about that part.
It's a heavy question, actually, because there's so many the minutiae behind the importance of art in creating any project is, from a commercial all the way to a film is a pretty detailed process. But I think early on, since I had an acting background, too, I completely understood the importance of that tactile nature and connection that helps and affect your character as a performer. So that was always in my brain. So when I started just directing, especially just directing and stuff, I knew going into it the importance of props and wardrobe and stuff and how it can help inform the character. I apologize, an ambulance. It was completely silent until just now. Of course, that's the way it works.
Happens.
The process of selecting the art and everything and the wardrobe and props, for me, having that acting background, I like to discuss it with my performers, my actors, as well, to help them be a part of the process in figuring out what it is that would really help them inform their performance more. So whether it's the way something fits wardrobe wise and colors and that sort of scheme and things like that, and the tiniest little details can tweak the way something is approached. A lot of people don't realize in the general audience, right, that like the smallest little detail can really help affect the way they approach something within a given moment within the thing. Like, and also it helps really connect with the audience too. It might seem like an insignificant thing, but like we'll talk about Freddy Krueger since he's featured in the movie, right? The sweater, actually I can't remember if he talks about he did. We definitely got him talking about the sweater, but I don't know if it's made it into the doc
No,
itself.
it's not in the film. The film will talk mostly about the claws.
Yeah, so but even so, but he talked to us in another instance about the sweater and how so much conversation went into finding that perfect sweater with those quintessential stripes, right? And that's become something that's so identifiable, like the two things, like even almost more so than the melted face is
Yeah.
the claws and the sweater. That's what people always think about and recognize within an instant. So you really want to have a conversation, and this is the way I work too, is you really want to have that conversation with your talent and make sure that they're involved in that process, because it's going to not only just save time in the filming itself, but really just affect, make or break sometimes the performances and stuff. So it's a very detailed process that you really have to focus on. And it's interesting is as we know, we're in a world now where props are becoming, I don't want to say they're a thing of the past, obviously, but they are becoming affected more and more because of CGI, right? So what seems like a physical prop is actually something on like a tennis ball on a stick, right? That just gets changed in post. And I know it's an acting process in itself, but the thing is it's you're slightly removing yourself from that emotional connection, you know what I mean? And you're putting your that organic element of discovery that sometimes comes across in each moment on film is kind of lost. And you're putting that much more on your actor, and that's fine because you want them to have a truly amazing performance no matter what, and you know that takes skill just from the actor, period. But there's nothing any actor I've talked to has had tons of CGI experience, so they're just like, yeah, I mean, nothing is as important as that real tactile thing that I can touch in my hand. I don't have to imagine it necessarily, you know what I mean? And so they feel slightly removed when it's CGI. And the more they do it, the more they get used to it, but they always say to me, it's like, no, it's always we prefer props, hands down. So yeah, and you find, some creatives nowadays too, like they have less experience working with performance and more on that CGI background and stuff. And so actors tend to be almost like an afterthought to the effect. So I know actors that I work with and stuff that they, not so much in this film, obviously, since it's a documentary, but like in my narrative stuff, they appreciate and love the fact that, we do things. I try to do as much as humanly possible in camera versus in post-production and stuff. So that's, I hope that answers your question.
No, it does. And the thing is like as an audience, as audience, when we're watching films, especially so many of the films, and I'll be like, we'll talk about it. I'll just say straight up, like the MCU films or the DCU films or like these films, especially the superhero genre, where so much VFX is used. Like we, the audience, I think it takes a lot away from our ability to relate to some aspects of the characters. For instance, like using Freddy Krueger as an example, like Robert Englund in the documentary, he talks about the different types of gloves they had because like some were used actual like blades made from a fish boning knife, and some were like resin like to, and wood to protect like the performers, and like that having that tangibility affects the way that they perform because you can tell when an actor you like the way he grabs someone, you know, this because he has an actual thing attached to his hand that has claws. You know, say so like affects the way that he holds it. But if it's a CGI or a strictly a VFX claw, like that tangibility is gone because like, he's not holding it. He's
Correct.
not holding his hand like the way you would hold your hand with claws, you know? And
And by the way, the details on each individual type of claw was like, if it was like a plastic thing, right, when he's scraping it across the chalkboard or
you're
on
not gonna get the sound, and then the sound, and then that also makes more work for like the Foley artist because the Foley artist is then gonna have to really try to like figure out, okay, like we don't have actual metal, so I'm gonna have to figure out a metal that works with this type of scene, you know, and like it has he has to like, and I think it's so I think like for the Valve VFX is saving a lot for the studios, a lot of money for the studios, and in some sense, it's taking away a lot from the performers and from the audience. And another thing is like when talking about the performers, like if I always like to use the example of a cup, like if is a cup just a cup, or is a cup, does this cup have a bigger meaning? And if the artist doesn't have a cup, they can't interact with the cup to look at the cup and say, you know, oh, like this is an interesting cup, you know, like they don't know what this thing is because they have no frame of reference for it. It's the VFX artist who working with the director who has to then create this cup after the fact, after shooting has been complete and after the actor has done their part. The VFX artist then has to composite this entire cup. But the artist in their performance has no frame of reference for this actual cup because they don't know what it's going to look like. And I think that affects a lot of stuff with like improvisation. Like improvisation, the art of improvisation in these particular films and in the use of some VFX is kind of being lost. Because when you watch like a lot of the behind the scenes for these films, like you mentioned, like for again the MCU films, a lot of these actors they say, oh, it kind of like affects their performance because they're like acting against a tennis ball, you know, and like the tennis ball has no personality, whereas something that has been crafted, whether it's something made specifically for the film or if it's like I'm like using the example of Mickey Rourke, he talked about money, you know, like he has an experience of counting money. You know, and like he knows how money feels, and that's so he has that as a frame of reference. Where, like, if the director say, "Oh, just imagine, is this thing?" and they're like, "But what particularly is this thing? What's the exact shape of it? The way you hold it is going to be affected by the shape of it." You know, like a prop gun, like for instance, a Magnum gun is going to have a completely different shape to a revolver, and the way that, and like you know, so it affects the way they interact with it, and we, the audience, pick up on that. For a lot of studios, they don't realize that. Yeah, we know this. Like I particularly, and I'm like, I know that you're not acting against a real cup. You know, I know you're not holding a real cup because like no one holds a cup like this because the actor can't hold a real cup. You know, so like just using that as an example. And then in talking about the beauty of having actual physical props, whether they're made for the film or not, if it's just something that the prop masters just found and say, oh no, this would be cool for a scene. It kind of like takes away the ability to really remember something specific about a scene. You know? Like for instance, like I'm a very visual person, so sometimes even if I don't remember a character's name, I can remember what a character wore. You know, or I can remember a particular thing that was around them. You know, I can remember, oh, the look of the house, you know, the cost, the set design and everything. Whereas if everything is being done in computer, it's not staying with me. Like I can't I wouldn't really remember, you know. And I think for and I think the film kind of highlights that in a kind of like a roundabout way where like for people who collect props, the reason they have such an emotional connection to these things is because it stands out in their mind. You know, all of the things that they collect are tangible, are made by other human beings. Their artwork is art pieces, things that people took hours and hours and hours to craft and putting little, even though you may not see it on the screen, when you hold it in your hand, you see all the little minute details. And I think your film really touches on that. So in saying all of that, first of all, we got to talk about just like making the decision to make the film because there isn't I'll say this now. One of the things that is being lost in filmmaking is like the behind the scenes specials. Growing up, I love one of the things I really loved about DVDs is that we would get the behind the scenes specials or even VHS tapes. You know, you get like a you get the
You're
actual VHS tape and then you get like a special feature VHS tape that you could rent, and then it was DVDs and you get all these special behind the scenes features and like the making of. And I used to love watching those. I would rent the making of DVDs just to watch them, but we don't get that now because everything again is VFX. You're not getting any the making of because like the making of is taking place in a computer. You know, it's not taking place in like a weather factory or IL and like you have ILM ILM, but like where's the making of specials for like these films now? You can't really have them. So talk about like you having your film be like kind of like I guess like a almost like a it's like a curated piece of like prop and prop history, you know, a film prop history in a way that's not being done now.
Yeah, it's I mean I wanted to make sure I mean it's hard because you also it could have been like a a 10-part miniseries, right? Depending on
It
how much details we wanted to go into. So, and at the same time, I wanted it to be something that appealed to the nerdiest of enthusiasts. But also captured the attention of the non cinephile as well, people who go to movies as a passive experience, and so that was like a line I had to balance. And it seemed to me that the most interesting thing would be to touch upon as much detail as I could without getting too cerebral. And so the importance I wanted to show how fascinating it was behind the scenes, like you're talking about, how these things are made, and why that had such an emotional impact on not just the curators and the museum operators and things like that who collect these things, but for those people, the casual collector too, who has them just displayed in their home and everything. And so I wanted to do justice to those actual artists who made these things. Because again, it's not just the actor, it's just like somebody is behind those details. So they're just as important, and I say this on all my sets, I always say that. I was like, nobody here is bigger, is more or less than any. Well, first of all, it should be like that in life, period. But on my sets and stuff, there's no, while there is obviously a hierarchy, I don't allow for anyone to be treated any differently because everybody plays a specific part that's super important to the overall whole. And so I wanted to show these artists and all the work that goes into those props and stuff that get created and the thought process behind it. And then it was cool because when we did the longest section, obviously, is when we go to Alec Gillis's Studio Gillis and Amalgamated Dynamics, which is an Oscar-winning, renowned studio and design studio and stuff, is having Robert Englund and Lance Henriksen go on the tour with us, because then you get to see, like, almost from start to finish, right? The people who designed it all the way to the people that actually use it. And so showing that interaction and how fascinated they are, especially Robert, because he's a big nerd, but the way he was always pointing, he's like, yeah, I love this detail here. That stuff is so important, right? And so I found when we had our premiere, several people who came, not several, a couple of people came up to me and said, you know, they were like, I gotta tell you, I was dragged to this movie by my significant other who's into this, right? And I thought I was going to be bored out of my mind, but I thought it was fascinating. It was so interesting. And that, to me, that's like the biggest compliment, because then you're like, you just won a new audience member who's now going to probably go see that next movie with a totally different viewpoint going into it. So that's something that I was really. It was really hard. It was difficult to do that, to pull that off, I think, because you know, it's a film, any film, filmmaking and enjoyment is, it's a subjective experience, right? You know, somebody may hate, you know, a movie, and other people are going to adore it for whatever reason, right? It's a personal experience, and that's the same thing that happens with props. Some people are more affected by science fiction props. Some people are more affected by props from Driving Miss Daisy. You know, it's all about that emotional connection that they have in that experience. And you can't have that experience without the artists behind those props being created.
And so now we're gonna kind of talk about the main character of this film, because while the film is of you go to Paris, you go to like Las Vegas, you know, you're in LA and you're in different cities, but there's one commonality, and that's the I'll call him the main character, Tal Bocchini, and he's a huge memorabilia collector, and like he spends a lot of money on these props and the bids, the numbers that I know in like a abstract sense that some of these things can sell for like hundreds of thousands of dollars. But like there's something interesting where you show him like on the phone with like his, I guess like his agent, in a sense where like they're big, like discussing the bids and how much bids. So like tell me first about getting in contact with Tom, and like how did you learn about him and about his memorabilia collection and working and getting him to agree to do the film?
So it was actually, well, here's a little background, is I've known Tom since he was a little kid.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we grew up, I was actually raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I've been in New York for more than half my life, and we had family in New York too. So New York was always my home away from home. And the second 6 days after graduating high school, ba-doom, I was in New York living. I had come back to back and forth to take care of my parents. So the benefit of doing what I do is technically I can be anywhere and do what I do, right? When I started coming back, I reconnected with Tom and learned things about him. I was closer with his older siblings. So I learned things about him, and he came to me one day, and he was just like, he pitched the idea.
Okay.
And he said, hey, dude, I don't know if you knew I was a collector. And I was like, oh no. And first of all, by the way, I've never been interested in collecting things. It doesn't, the most I collect are any new city I go to, I get a magnet. That's it. That's it. Which I get made, fun of too. My late wife would say the same thing. She's like, oh my God, you're such a dork. And I was like, if
Yeah, but
she,
you've seen nothing
if,
yet.
yeah, it's like, if you had to see, if she'd gotten a chance to meet Tom, she'd be like, oh no, you're not a dork. Anyway, so Tom pitched the idea. He's like, is there a show in this? And I said, well, first of all, TV, there's the two most difficult entertainment things are music and TV. And if you're not a legacy in TV, like you come from, you know, a long line of TV royalty, Or you're not already super connected, or you're a movie star already, you're not, it's so difficult to get into TV. And so I said, while I do know some people, I don't, the chances of me getting, it's going to take years, if at all. And so I said, I think you're better off doing a documentary and then using that as a way to pitch as a TV show. So you're getting a movie, and you, which gives you the chance as a businessman to actually perhaps make some money back versus spending money on a pilot that will never turn out to be anything. And then maybe we can use that. And as a result, we are actually in very active conversations with four majors, networks slash streamers that are now interested in doing the show as a result of the movie. And so Tom, and one of the things he was most concerned about, by the way, was the fact that he didn't want it to seem like, and this was something that I insisted on too, is he was nervous. His biggest concern was coming across as some sort of entitled jerk, right? Because, oh, I have this money that I'm spending. And so that was one of the things that I wanted to make sure came across too, not just for him so that he would look good. Because he, by the way, one of the first things people say is he's like the most endearing person. He just seems so fun, and not, that is 1000% authentic. He is hands down one of the kindest, sweetest, most enthusiastic and optimistic, positive people I've ever known in my entire life. I wanted to make sure that we showed that it wasn't really about the money, right? This isn't some abstract world that is virtually impossible. Because otherwise, how do you connect with it, right? To me, there's those people that love seeing all these people like on these reality shows, right? And they blast, this is this much money, this much money, right? And they just find it, they like live vicariously through that. Oh, I wish I was rich. But in this case, it was really so, it was about showing that you don't have to even be wealthy to be a part of this community. You can be, and that's why when we were going into it, I wanted to do it organically and discover things so that when we were at the actual prop store auction, I was just when we met that one of the final people that we see on camera, which is
Alistair, I believe his name, yes.
when my producer, because one of my producer's jobs was to specifically go around meeting individual people, because it's impossible for me to do that.
Yeah.
Their job was to go around and get little stories from everybody to see who might be super interested in getting on camera. She came to me and said, oh my God, this guy. And she told me the story, and I was like, we have to talk to him. And to me, he's the emotional core of that, the entire movie. He is that every man that really shows that anybody can be a part of this. You know, this is a guy who makes 10 pounds an hour. And it's like, and lives at home and blah, blah, blah. And he just has this dream of having this one little obscure thing from something that barely anybody even really knows, that is within his budget range and reach, right?
Correct.
And to me, that was just beautiful. And people have told me in the screenings too, they're like, yeah, that's when I saw that guy, I was just like, oh, that moved me like crazy. And I was like, yeah. So that was super important to me. And then having all those juxtapositions really starts to help show that just because Tom is of a certain ilk, you know, and ability financially, doesn't mean he feels like he's better or any than anyone else. Everybody in this community is an equal, and that's one of the things that I actually found very fascinating about it. Doesn't make me want to collect props, but that's just me. I mean, I'm just wired that way.
It's true because the thing is like, but Alistair, like, you know, I can relate to Alistair. I can't relate to Tom or to any of the other guys because I don't got that kind of money. But like Alistair, I can relate to Alistair. He's like, I'm here just to get like the technical drawing of a film. And I remember it's a show that he said his brother named him after the character in the show. Right. And so like for him, that has a personal connection because like that's something that's connected to him and his family personally. And like that I can relate to. And it made me kind of think if I could, if and it made me think if I could have an actual prop from a show or TV or film, what would it be? And I started to think, and I was like, I was thinking, if I could, it would be the katana that Michonne has from The Walking Dead. But I know that's like an impossibility. But if I could, if I had the money, it would be that. And then maybe like a replica of the train from the KTX from Train to Busan. And that's like one of my all-time favorite movies.
Oh, Train to Busan? I just
Train to
rewatched
Busan.
that like a week ago.
It's like one of my all-time favorite movies, top three for me. And if I could get like a replica of like the KTX, the train, or and then one of my other favorite movies of all time is the Lady Vengeance from the Vengeance trilogy by Park Chan-wook. You know, everybody knows Old Boy. Like the second film in that series, Lady Vengeance is actually I think better than Old Boy. But there's if I could get like a something from like maybe her coat, that like she has a spectacular black leather coat, like that's something that I would wear it too. I wouldn't just keep it, I would wear it. But like it made me think, well, if I could have something, what would it be? And then I started to think, okay, like even if I can't have these things, you can have people who make replicas or even paintings of them. Like I have two paintings in my I that I have. One is a painting of Okoye and Nakia from Black Panther, and it's a painting that I got at Comic Con. I went to Comic Con in 2019, and I got another painting of Moana. And like there, you can have these. There may not be actual replicas or things from the film, but if you go to places like San Diego Comic Con or go to like conferences, you can get like pieces of this memorabilia. You know, you can have people who create these things out of the pure love for it. And for me, doing my, I think for me, doing interviews with like filmmakers, kind of me is like my own way of collecting memorabilia because I get to talk to the people who make these films and make these stories and are involved in the filmmaking process. They kind of look at it for me. You know what? I'd be like, you know what? That's how I'm gonna look at it. I'm collecting my own
Yeah, but by the
memorabilia.
way, incidentally, you know, you people need to realize too that it's not if you put in your mind all from the get-go, oh, there's no way I'll be able to afford that. You're the one selling yourself short, because if you look at Sean Lespinera, who was in the guy who had a lot of Wolverine stuff, very very modest home, right? And not like, oh, he's not a wealthy person, right? And he has like a massive collection of props and stuff. So it's like, rather than, hey, you know what, maybe I'm just not, I'll drink one less latte every day, you know, that I buy. There's ways around it. It's just budgeting, right? But he, for instance, the hammer, the mold, God, I always mess up that, you know,
Mjolnir,
from Thor, and the Avengers. You would think that, that being such an iconic prop, that they would be crazy expensive, but no, they're not. It's all about researching and finding, you know, maybe the Mjolnir that I got wasn't was only was briefly on screen, right? And they made 20 of these, so the price automatically went down because there were so many versions of it made for the movie. So that's one thing. And you know, the more it's been used on screen and it's proved that it was screen used, the more expensive it's going to get. But don't sell yourself short. So if somebody really wants something, if you really want that Michonne thing, remember that was for like 12 seasons. It's there.
And well, there's don't forget there's a new season coming out, the
And
one that so like
there's probably a collection of the sword out there, of the katana out there
no, they probably
that
made
you
like
can
40. They
afford.
probably made like 40 of those anyway. So you're right. You know what? Maybe.
More, I guarantee you, more than that.
Yeah. So and so like in talking about that in like the different ways of collecting, I like that the film also shows different types of collectors. Like we mentioned, there's like the people who are curators who like one of the people you went to, he was it's I put his name here. His name is Luca
Lucas
Cardini, and
Ferrari.
he's a props curator in Italy, and like his setup is like a museum, and it's because he's like I want to collect something very specific, and there's and so like that's his method of curating, where he wants things that have been done only once on screen, and like they're a particular size and a particular and I noticed like a lot of them have a very particular in a particular genre of filmmaking, so there's like that, and then there's one person who has like things worn by the actual actors. Like he has like one of the dresses worn by Whitney Houston. And it doesn't only have to be movie related. It can be related to like conference concert performances like from Michael Jackson And you know, like the shirt that Aunt Jamie Foxx wore. So there's different types of collectors. You know, there's people who focus on mainly a small, like the action figures from the 70s and the 80s. And then there's people who have like museums that have like massive actual like full scale replicas of things. So like, I like that the film focuses on these different types of curation. So talk to me about finding. So we talked about Tom. So talk about the other people that you interviewed, like working and like you and your producer saying, okay, like there's a museum in France. Like, how do we get in contact with them? And like, you know, like finding the collector in England and getting contact with them.
That was one of the hardest parts of the entire process because while it's a very welcoming community to collectors themselves, they're very wary about outsiders, for many different reasons. For I don't want to get robbed if they find out what I have and stuff like that, and et cetera, et cetera. And so I had to basically I from scratch. I was like, looked at Facebook groups, try to see this. Can I get into this? And like at first, people were denying me because you're not a collector, so we're not just gonna let anybody into this thing, right? So it took several months. Oh, actually, it took about 2 months until finally I found a collector who was in the movie. Nick Gigi and his cousin Jacob in Colorado. Somehow, I found them and he responded. And then he just did his due diligence on me and saw, hey, this guy's he's for real. He's not just some Joe Schmo. He's done all this work. He's in the business for a long time. So he and I chatted, and then once he realized, oh no, this guy's legit and he really wants to make something that's not like I'm not mocking this the community or anything like that. He, being a super respected member of the collecting community, started telling everybody else, hey guys, I wanted to let you know about this guy, but he's making a thing. And then from that point on, it was just like then I couldn't fight them off with a stick. They started all finding me after that. So we just did a, I just made like a database of every collector, everything they had, as much detail as we could. And then we just kind of, I wanted it to be as international as I possibly could to show how just like traditional art, they exists, it exists worldwide. These people from just passing collectors to curators and museums and stuff too. So I had to pick and choose, unfortunately, and then in the end, just based on budget, because we had a decent budget, but we didn't have it wasn't unlimited, right? So we could only go so far. And then obviously too, one of the most expensive parts of making the film, by far the most expensive thing, was travel. So to get to these places, so we had to there was a finite amount of things we could cover, in order to achieve the basic structure of what I wanted to achieve in the film, which is why I'm very happy that I have that database, because now I was able for the pitch to the networks and streamers to do outlines showing all the different episodes across multiple seasons that are possible because of all the collectors that I now have in my database. So that's basically, yeah, how I went about it. It was just flat out cold calling or cold emailing, if you will.
So a couple of things you mentioned I know I need to, but for something I do want to talk about first before I forget is you mentioned the budget. So talk to me about budgeting a film like this because you did travel to like England, Paris, and Italy and also to different states within the US. So talk about the budgeting and like how you got the money to make this film. And I was wondering also about licensing because you are showing scenes from different films and from different studios, you do have to pay licensing fees, I would imagine for showing like actual scenes with dialogue and then also like possibly with copyright. So talk about the logistics of making a film like this.
Yeah, so for the investor and stuff, it was really just about kind of setting like a standard as far as like how much does the average documentary of this scale cost? Like, what's the average cost of those? So you have to kind of research all those things, and then you have to base it upon like how much was this film. And this is all information that, if you know what you're doing, you can find like this film was made for this much and it sold for this much, and so they were able to profit this much. So you have to have all these comparables to and projections to give to the investor, and right. So that's kind of how we wound up where we wound up budgetarily. But then also oh gosh, sorry, what was the second part of that question?
Getting the licensings for
Oh
like
yeah. So yeah. That is, that's a fear, right? So one of the things was can we shoot this in a way where the pieces themselves are enough, or do we need to have references? And so it's really just about, I think the difference was that while it's cool because the collector who loves the Mjolnir again for that reference from whatnot, they know that it's from an Avenger movie or from Thor or whatever, right? So they don't necessarily need to see a clip because they've seen it a million times. But for the average moviegoer who might not have seen that, having a clip is handy, right? So we didn't focus so much on what clips we could use. We just focused on just the props. Then when I went down and started whittling down the script into what would become the actual final outline of the film in post, that's when I went and started saying, okay, so here would be a great moment for this, this, this. Then you have to understand the process of, just laws and stuff like that. So obviously I had budgeted a legal clearance attorney. So we had one of the best legal clearances attorneys in the industry. Which also not as expensive as people would think. You know what I mean? It just all depends on how much you need. So I'd say these are the clips we need, or I'd like to have ideally. And then they're like, okay, well, this actually, if you only use a certain length, and it's used for a particular purpose, in other words, you're utilizing it, isn't like deliberately a manner for you to make money for yourself. In other words, you're stealing from us, but you're using it as an homage and as a reference. It's kind of like just like any like thesis, right? You put all the info in the end too, and
Make
all
sure you're not plagiarizing.
exactly. And so that's basically it. As long as you're giving the proper credit and the proper, you're utilizing what legally you're okay to use, and you have a legal background, a legal counsel that actually scrutinized everything and can prove that yes, it was used for this and that was the purpose and blah 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 blah, then you're set. You know what I mean? So we didn't honestly, we didn't spend a dime, not one dime. It was all fair use. So that's how we were able to get all the clips that we used, and we could use more, but I also didn't want it to become about the movie, all the clips. I didn't want it to be like a clip thing, and because that becomes a crutch in and of itself. But without those, we wouldn't be able to have attracted more general audiences, right? So that they feel more connected now because they also have a reference because of those clips and stuff. And so that's how we went about it. Otherwise, it would have been completely cost prohibitive.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't have been able to make the movie at all.
And in talking about that, so like, and I think it's even for someone like me who watches oh so many movies and TV shows, like there were some references that made me curious. Like there's the I think I've seen The Outsiders maybe once years ago, but because you went to the actual house from the film, like they built the entire house for the film, it made me curious about going and looking up the film and like refreshing my memory because it's been literally years since I watched that as a young child back in the day. So like that, so like because you didn't need you, I think you had like one clip from the film, but because the house itself serves as a reference and like because the way how they have the design of the house set up, it makes the audience more curious to watch it. And like even for like Mickey Rourke, you didn't add a clip of the film he was referencing, But it would make you go and look up on his IMDb and say, okay, like what film could he possibly be talking about? And then make you curious to go and watch the film that he's referencing, right? And so like, yeah, like making sure that you use particular scenes from specific movies, for especially when you have the actors talking about it, you can use the clips from those films because it makes it kind of like, in a way, shows like how the actors themselves are fans of these props, you know, like how they themselves have a personal connection, which is kind of like what we were talking about at first, where like having the props not only helps the actor with their performance, but it actually shows that they themselves are fans of the artwork, the craft of making props, because they have so much respect for the prop masters and for the makers. And I think it's important for the audience to get to see that the actors, they themselves have connections to these things. So now talk about getting like Robert Englund, Mickey Rourke, and oh my gosh, why am I drawing a blank on his name?
Lance Henriksen.
And right on to be in the film.
Well, so we had a, I mean, I had a laundry list of different actors we wanted to get to, like because we show like Rocky IV's boots for Dolph Lundgren's character of Ivan Drago that Tom owns. We tried to get them, and so some people, a lot of people were either not available or not interested for whatever reason or another, or I don't do documentaries, et cetera, so there were tons of reasons, and so but when it came down to it, a lot of it had to do with the fact that the majority of props of all the lists that came to me from collectors as we were prepping the film, a lot of it was aliens. Aliens is like the Alien franchise was like one of the most collected film franchises out there. So Lance was, you're either. You either love aliens more or you love Alien more, like the first one.
Yeah.
So Aliens was like, I like them both equally because I just think they're two totally different kind of styles. So anyway, it seemed like a no-brainer to get Lance, and and one of my producing partners in LA is very friendly with all the agencies, and that's how we were able to get Lance and Robert. And Robert especially was an exciting get for Tom because he nerded out. He was just like, oh my God, Freddy Krueger, because of his he originally wanted to be, when he was a kid, he was interested in being a special makeup effects artist in the industry. So for him, that was super cool. And anybody who's a child of the 80s, essentially, regardless if you love horror, you're like, oh cool, that's cool, like it's that retro thing, you're like, oh that's awesome, Freddy Krueger, cool. And then Mickey was I knew that Mickey was really more of a I knew he was going to be more of a character, if you will, a little saltier than the others. So I thought he would be an interesting person just to get his take on it, because he had a totally different, like his thing was like he doesn't actually love big props. And stuff. He thinks it's a crutch. So for him, it's the smaller details that matter versus like the big things, So like for him, he didn't really enjoy the overall process of a lot of his films, especially the bigger Hollywood ones. He actually didn't enjoy doing them for those reasons, right? Versus Robert and Lance, who were like super excited about the that artistic connection with the prop makers and the wardrobe and all that stuff. They totally love it. And it's just different. Every actor is different. So that's it. So I wanted to show those differences and stuff. And then obviously it was cost prohibitive to have 15 actors in it. You know what I mean? So it's just like the couldn't go to every city to film. I couldn't get every actor I wanted to do it, right? So
No, I think
and it would have been a 50 hour movie.
yeah, no, for sure. But I think the ones that you did get were important because, like, again, aliens, and then like, and then and having them go to the studio with Alec and have them interacting with them and showing that they themselves were geeking out over like the animatronics and stuff. I think that was really interesting and
That
very.
was dumb luck too, by the way. Just change. That was dumb luck that we happened to be shooting all that around the same time, and they happened to both know Alec. Or like, I was like, oh, what if you can we do the interviews at Alec's place? This is where we shot those interviews. Like, Hey, would you mind hanging out and doing it? Yeah, we'd love to. That's awesome. Because to them, it was just hanging out, and they're geeks, so they're all into it. So,
And I think, and like for me, like I personally, I'm the kind of person, I've only done a few set visits, and like, but I love being on set and seeing the actual props and like the how they build houses. Like, so many people don't realize that for a lot of films and shows, like they actually build actual houses and stuff, and like every so many things are made specifically for these films, and like having them be just as nerdy about the whole process as like as we would say regular fans, it kind of re remind people like yes, they are actors, but they're also regular people too, and they themselves are fans of movie making. And then having with Alec in particular, he is the films that he's worked on are some of the films that he's worked on are some of the most like popular sci-fi films ever, you know. And like seeing like the again seeing the artists, like one of the guys that were there was working in studio and working on props at that time, so you got to see that. But then also I like that there is someone else that you had in the film. You okay?
yeah, no, one of my dogs is crying for attention inside.
Oh, okay. Again, my dog is here. My dog is here next to me. So every time I keep looking in the corner of my eye to see if she's gonna do something, but she's good now. but one of the other people that I like that you have in the film is David Reed James, and he's a sculptor and a prop maker, and he's worked on some other. He's worked both with physical props, but I think he's also done like some VFX first because like he's worked on films like Black Panther. And then that when he was talking, it kind of made me think I would definitely like to have something from the Black Panther film, you know. And like I think it's again also important to show the people making these artworks, because something else that was really sticking in my mind is when you were interviewing the other collectors, they know the films, they know the details, they know the directors and the actors, but they don't name the people who make these things, you know. And like and that kind of made me think so many people I collect these thousands upon thousands of people and people and collect all these from the smallest little pieces of art and sculpture to like full costumes, you know, and everything, but they couldn't tell you the name of the person making them, you know. They don't
Well,
know.
and then it's kind of hard though, because there's so many artisans that go behind.
They are, but you know what I mean. But there's like kind of like this thing where in Hollywood where you don't really focus on the people who are crafting them, you know. So that when you showed him, I was so happy that you showed him, because I'm like, yes, show us the people making these things, you know. Same thing like we were no costume designers for films like you have again using Black Panther as a reference, Ruth E. Carter, but she's just the leader of the costume department. She has like a whole team of costume makers.
An army.
We don't know the names of those peoples, right? So I think films like this and documentaries like this are important to kind of like, in a way, humanize the filmmaking process, you know. So it's not just the glitz and the glamours. Like you got to remember, there are people who are spending hours and so much labor and time and effort and talent and energy making these things. Like they also deserve acknowledgement as well.
Yeah. No, and there were I honestly we did film other people like David. But again, it was just a matter for the sake of time. Like I couldn't, you know, there's tons of stuff. Oh, I can't even tell you how much we shot. We have so much footage that obviously didn't make it into the film. Like the
Would you do
first
a part two then?
No, I think well, some of the stuff like I'm actually, you know, I can use for the show, for the TV show.
Right. If you that's why I'm hoping you get the show
Yeah,
because
there's some stuff I can use later on and stuff. But yeah, I mean, yeah, for the sake of time and whatnot, I couldn't obviously include everybody. And there was some interesting stuff, but it was, you know, you go down a rabbit hole and it's just like impossible. And the same thing with like costumes and stuff. I was super interested in getting into costumes after we were with Paul and his little mini home museum, right? With the Michael Jackson and all that stuff. But the thing
Right.
is, you start to go down this rabbit hole and you know, it's again, and then it just will become like this huge thing. So these are things that I would like to go back to and visit in more detail, which is easier to do in a show versus, you know, a film. So.
Yeah, I hope you do get the I hope you do get the show, because that's one of the reasons that I do interviews is to not only for my own curiosity and knowledge, but also to like for people to like realize that film isn't just the director and the main actors. You know, film is costume designers, film is the lighting technician, film is the set designer, film is the prop master, you know, film is the accountant. You can't make a film without your content. You can't make a film without craft services, you know? Like you have all of these people involved in the filmmaking process. So I really do hope you get to do the show to kind of like give them their own moment and time in the spotlight, especially with the way that film is going now, where, as we mentioned at the beginning, so much of it is VFX. And like Hollywood is pushing this whole AI, generative AI thing. And I'm like, this is kind of like trying to certain things like tangible costume design, the way of the dinosaurs, you know, and so I think it's important to remind people this is why these things are important. These aspects of the behind the scenes are what gets you to, or what leads to the final product that you spend so much energy and time loving. You know, like you go to the film, you go to the theater, you fall in love with Star Wars. You can't have a Star Wars without a prop master. You know, like. You know what I mean? Like,
And you can see the difference, right, between like the original trilogy and then the newer trilogy, which is where it's like clearly so effects heavy versus the original stuff where they actually used massive models and stuff versus CGI and stuff. And that, by the way, that's not, I no way mean to like trash talk CGI because I love big CGI spectacles. I think
for sure.
super fun, and that's an artistry in and of itself. But for the sake of this particular process and this storyline, the tactile thing is different. So that's no disrespect to the artist's
Well,
face.
for sure, because I have great respect for VFX artists, because the way they create something from a few lines of code in a computer, my brain does not comprehend like making code. So like I have huge respect for those guys and for everyone who works in VFX, and like I don't know people on Twitter that I mutual with who works for ILM, you know, and who works on like Star Wars and Star Trek and all these shows. So I have great respect for them. It's just, but they themselves also talk, like we talk a lot on Twitter and stuff. We also, they themselves have a great respect for the tangible aspects of film. You know, they themselves are fans of props. You know, they themselves are fans of like costume designing and actual painting and all of this stuff. And so I think for me, for me, it's about how the studios are looking at film now more than the creators itself. It's the studio. So much of this generative AI is coming, push is coming from the studio execs, you know, where it's like, do people even understand filmmaking? Do we even understand and love the industry and the genre of art that that you're involved in? And then it's like, it's all about the money making, but I'm like, people fell in love with film because of these things. Like, if you're taking away the things that we love about film, what are you doing? You know? So, like, I think the filmmaking industry is changing. And the funny thing is like, one of the questions something I do want us to talk about before we wrap up is in the seven, and it's mentioned in the film, the 70s and the 80s was a very pivotal time in Hollywood, and not just in Hollywood, but in the international film industry, because the 70s and 80s is when films where people really start to pay attention to props and collecting props, you know, and this is where the studios started to say, hey, wait, if we make a film like Back to the Future, we can actually start to sell memorabilia. You know, they're like, this is another avenue of making money, you know, and then started working with places with things like
Actually,
McDonald's in particular, where they'd be like, how about we work with McDonald's and have them to make replicas of these things from shows and films and sell them to consumers, you know, and then like film became more, it has become much more consumer based, where it's like everyone has kind of like maybe a replica or a toy, a plastic toy of something that you go to an amusement park or a theme park and you can shoot a balloon and you win a stuffed toy, a stuffed replica of a dinosaur from Jurassic Park or whatever, you know, can might not be the actual thing because of copyright purposes, but you know it's a dinosaur referencing Jurassic Park, you know. And so I want us to talk a bit about the consumer aspect of filmmaking and how they the I think the idea of memorabilia collecting is different now than it would have been in like the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s. Is a bit more it's a, I think it's a bit more different now. I think people are, again, and I think it's because there's not many films now where you can look at a film and say, I want a collector's. The thought just occurred to me. Okay, an example would be the Batmobile. Nice. The Batmobile, like I remember, like there were collectors' memorabilia, small little replicas of the Batmobile being sold. We don't have many films like that where you can like kind of say, oh, wouldn't it be cool to have a replica of the Batmobile? And I think it's kind of funny, like you have, again, using Black Panther, there's no replicas of the spaceship that T'Challa and Okoye flew. And I think like Hollywood's kind of moving away from that, you know, where it's like they're not really catering to the love of these small aspects of the film. It's more about the actual brand itself, the Black Panther brand. We want you to love the brand of Black Panther. We want you to love the MCU as a brand, but they're not really giving us actual things to love as part of these. You know what I mean? So I want you to talk a bit about the change, how it's kind of gone from this, is almost kind of doing like a full 360, where it's kind of like going from no memorabilia to collect to now all of the memorabilia you could possibly want and collect to now there's not really anything to collect.
I kind of feel like they're actually don't want to say there's been like a resurgence necessarily, but I do think that there's I as this, by the way, because as this world of collecting becomes more and more respected, which it has in the past 15, 20 years especially, and the value is starting to really be seen behind that, I think it's going to change, and it is going to come back to that heyday of having more and more pieces out there and stuff, you know, not just the physical things, but also the, like I said, everybody can own like a replica of the thing and stuff. So I think it's, I honestly think it's going to become more and more popular and stuff like that. It's a movement that's already been happening and whatnot. I think the problem with like paying respect to the artist and stuff, that's something that's going to probably stay like that, you know. People are still not going to really necessarily fully under grasp the importance of the artist behind these things, but the overall respect to props and costumes and stuff like that, I think it is getting better and more important. Not it's not going to change the fact that CGI is still going to be the thing, right? But I think they're going to start seeing that more and more, like studios, and they're seeing more and more the value of it as they've opened their own major museums for props and stuff from film.
Right. And so like the props are going there, so they're not really going into collectors because the collectors, well,
Well,
Disney is
they can't
making
hold everything. I mean, it's not like they're going to put 50 Mjolnirs on display, right? They're going to put like a specific one that is the most valuable one, right, or whatnot. I'm sure there was probably, I don't know if there were more than one Ruby Slippers, but from Wizard of Oz, but obviously they're gonna have like the hero one, and somebody else in a private collection might have, you know, blah 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 blah. So but yeah, so I think they're starting to really grasp the importance behind it, both artistically and culturally and you know, behind those things. So, you know, and I think like Black Panther is a good example of something that like culturally it really had a powerful effect in for African culture and stuff like that, right? That was what inspired so much of the props and wardrobe especially, right? So like head masks and things like that, and that sort of beautiful world and the way they recreated that market, right, in Wakanda, right, and stuff, and paid such beautiful reverence to that and whatnot, that, you know, that's also important. I think that's an even greater thing. Not only did it showcase possibility of some cool pro, by the way, the spaceship, I just don't think it was featured enough for it to be really anything that anyone cared about, as much as they do like, you know, the Black Panther outfit and
Yeah, well, and that's on display because I actually saw that in person. I went to San Diego Comic Con in 2019. They had all the costumes on display, and I did get to see them up close and like the detail that they put into those costumes. And I've interviewed Ruthie Carter a couple of times, and
Oh, nice.
I'm just like, I want to touch them. But like, yeah, but like the thing is, again, that's like Disney's like, we're gonna hold on to these things. You can't come and buy them, like, so you know, it's not like I can find my. Which is also in a good way because it means that they're not in a private collection where like limited people can see them. But if they're in a studio or a museum, like people can like go and watch and look at all of, look and
Yeah. I mean, I think it's cool. It's cooler for everybody to get a chance to see it, you know?
And then
Everyone wants to see the Mona Lisa. Everybody wants to see it, right?
as you were talking, I did remember like for the Barbie movie, Mattel is back on their grind now. Like they're like doing the whole Mattel universe. I hope it never happens, please. For just for a whole host of reasons. But yeah, but anyways, but as you were talking about, oh wait, yeah, Mattel is talking about doing the whole Barbie's universe, which is like absurd, but
Yeah, it's a blessing and a curse, right? I mean, I think the movie in general was a very powerful film in terms of like feminism and showcasing individuality and stuff like that, but at the same time, the commercial aspect to it that's going to result from its success is
yeah,
all.
it's gonna be like Barbie Inception. It's gonna be like a Barbie of a Barbie movie of a Barbie. Like it's like what? But something. So before we wrap up, I do like I want you to talk now about your upcoming projects because we had talked about it a bit before we began recording. So talk to me about your next. Oh, first of all, no, I want us to talk about that first, and then where people can watch Mad Props after. But first, tell us about your next project. What are you working on?
So we're going into production on a supernatural horror thriller called Theirs. That is set to start filming in the summer, probably June. Actually, I have a call right after this interview. For that. So we it stars Rita Moreno, Harvey Keitel, Rosalind Sanchez, Udo Kier, and then we have a couple of other names that might be joining the cast as well. It's a small cast, but it's a very intimate film and takes place almost entirely in one location. It's a very creepy little story, but I wrote it, but I wrote it specifically with a female director in mind. Like I thought it would be because it's a female-centric film, and I was like, I feel like it's better for a female to direct this. So we have a great director named Sonia O'Hara, who's actually in the process of exploding as a director. So we're super psyched about that and going into production on that. And then after that, we have a film called Crybaby Hill, which is a horror comedy. And we've started attaching some well-known talent to that as well, and hopefully that'll shoot late summer. And then we have a Western, and I'm directing that one, and I wrote it and I'm directing that one. And then the Western called Whirlwind, I wrote and I'm directing as well, which is it's a drama. It's a slight action, but more just like a romantic drama set in 1865. And so that's it. But then we have a whole bunch of other things. We have the show, and we have the show version of Mad Props in the works. I have two other documentaries that have come as a result of the success so far of Mad Props. And Mad Props, it's going to have a small theatrical rollout in the few cities, including France and Italy, but a few cities in the States and California and Texas and Oklahoma. And then that starts in about at the end of on March 1st, actually. And then after that, it'll be available for the masses on TVOD and for rent and buy, and you can buy it and rent it on just about every major platform. And then we're still in the process of getting the licensing together for the home it will have on like a streamer, like a Netflix or Hulu. And that would be for the end of April. So yeah, so it'll be available for the masses in just a little over a month.
You're gonna have a busy rest of 2024. Like, what,
I know, right? I'm
three things
excited.
you're working on? And one thing I did want to ask, I forgot to ask earlier, and you mentioned like the importance of having a female director for theirs. I want to ask, I noticed for the film there aren't any female collectors, but within the film
There
itself.
are. There are, but they're way there's way fewer than there are, and there's a lot of husband and wife collectors as well. But again, it was just a matter of like, first of all, they didn't really pop up in the initial research when I was putting together the list of collectors. But then when we went to prop store for the auction, I met a bunch.
Yeah, there were some there, in England.
So some of them, we almost went to shoot one that was in England. This Emma Jane Napier is a collector that we met there and whatnot, and she supposedly has like a bunch of cars and stuff too. So I was like, oh, that sounds great, but we just didn't have the time. Just didn't have the time because
Cars and even
we weren't there for like 2 weeks. We were just there for a few days.
Oh, okay. Well, I that will be hers will be interesting because I'm actually I used to be very interested in cars when I was younger. I used to watch shows like Orville Holland, and there was an English show where they would talk about both like cars for like racing, and they also felt cars from like films like the Aston Martins. And I was like, if I had money, the car I would own would be an Aston Martin, which is a car James Bond drives. But like she would be interesting like for the car collectible. So we wrap up here now. But again, thank you so much, Juan, for talking with me. And I hope that the show does get made because I do miss the behind the scenes features we used to get for films. And this, I think, like for Mad Props, it does serve as a behind the scenes look at film and the collectible and the collecting and memorabilia process. So I hope a lot of people get to watch it and will be interested in watching the films mentioned in the documentary. So thank you so much, yay.
No, I can't thank you enough for having me. It was my pleasure. So, and I'm so glad that you enjoyed it enough to spread the word and stuff. And hopefully, you'll be able to spread it to more and more audience members.
So, everyone, this was another episode of Carol and Tossin. In this episode, I spoke to filmmaker Juan Reynoso to talk about his documentary, Mad Props, detailing the life and adventures of prop collectors and museum curators for films of all genres from Hollywood and all around the world. And it was really interesting to get to watch this film because it reminded me so much of the blooper reels that we used to get at the end of films and this behind the scenes footage that we used to get. You know, in DVDs and VHS tapes where we used to see like the actors and the directors using the props, but also sometimes you'd also get a tidbit of like in the productions rooms where like you see the prop masters and the prop makers making these things and costume designers working with them. And for me, I've personally done interviews with like costume designers and production designers, and I've never interviewed a prop maker. I'm gonna make that one of my goals for this year. But I've done set visits, you know, where I've seen the prop masters working with the props, you know, laying them out on set for the cast to use. So it was like kind of interesting and cool to get to talk to Juan about that aspect of filmmaking and film fandom and film curation and museum curation. But also because he himself is a filmmaker who has worked on so many different projects, he has that background knowledge of it from a fan, but also as someone who directs people on how to use these things. So it's interesting to get to speak to him. And I thank him very much for talking with me about the film. And I think also making it because I think, as I mentioned in the interview, so many people don't have an appreciation of the people who make these props. They love the props, they collect them, but they don't really know the people who make them, you know? And even sometimes I'll say the studios don't really show value to these people. Like if you watch like a lot of the big award shows now, they don't pay attention to these things. Like, you know, back in the day, like you'd watch like the Oscars, for instance, you'd have like these special, like they do make a big production of having the actors wear their costumes, you know, to show like the audience and the people watching these things on TV, the costumes being worn in real life, not just on screen, but in real life. And like you'd have reenactments of like specific scenes. I remember one of the ones that sticks in my head is the scene from Craft. You know, it was like this big movement choreography of dancing and like singing the theme song for the film. But we haven't had that kind of appreciation for this aspect of filmmaking art in a while. So I think the film is really interesting in that way. And hopefully, you know, like he gets to make it into series and people get to watch it. And so and I hopefully, as I said, I hope to get to speak to a prop maker and a prop master sometime this year. And that would be really cool. I'm going to make that one of my goals. But I hope you guys enjoy listening to this interview. Of course, you can watch the video version of this and other interviews that I've done on my YouTube channel. That's tutu.com/@signcarolyn_hines. You can also look up under the new title where I put it as Carolyn Talks Podcast and YouTube channel. That's on YouTube, but also in my R3 page, you can find it there as well as that. And of course, my R3 page is r3.com. That's authry.com/CarolynHines. Find links to all of my published work there, the YouTube channel, the different podcasts that I have, which is Carolyn Talks, or you can also find it on So Here's What Happened, but also Beyond the Romance, my Asian drama podcast. And if you go on my YouTube channel, you'll see work that I do with AFCA, the African American Film Critics Association there. My social media is on Twitter and Instagram. That's Carrie. CNH12, that's at CARRIECNH12. Always find me on Twitter talking, and I'm posting work on my Instagram as well, and sometimes videos of my dog Yoko. And I'm working on more interviews. Like this one is gonna publish before my interviews for the Hot Docs, which is a competition film festival in Toronto. Let me get the correct title. It is the Hot Docs Canadian International Documentary Festival. And it's held in Toronto. And I'm doing some interviews for that as well. So look up for those upcoming interviews. And until the next episode of Carolyn Talks, everyone, stay safe. Bye.